to move his admission. He's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois and in the state of Louisiana, where he worked for a number of years. His grandfather, I'm sure, would be very proud of what he does now because he's with the state appellate defender. He went to undergraduate at Duke and Northwestern for law school. So I'm, as I said, very pleased to move his admission.
Mr. Swigert, we are very pleased to grant the motion for your admission, and if you would step over and be sworn, we'll be a member of the bar of this court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We look forward to seeing you often. All right, now we will hear case number 092796, Lingus against Dorazil. Mr. Mills.
Good morning. In granting summary judgment to the defendants in this ERISA case, we believe that the district court committed three separate errors of law, one relating to the plaintiff's claim of a breach of the duty of prudence, the other two errors of law relating to the claim for breach of the duty of loyalty. The error with respect to the breach of the duty of prudence is that the district court held that ERISA Section 404C provides, assuming that its requirements are satisfied, provides a complete defense to a claim for breach of the duty of prudence. We respectfully disagree. We believe there are four separate avenues from which the court can conclude otherwise. The first is the rehearing opinion in the Hecker v. Deere case. Unfortunately, the district court did not have the benefit of that decision and relied on the earlier opinion, which, while not deciding the issue, certainly contained an extensive discussion of 404C and its requirements in the context of a 401K plan involving various investment alternatives.
Now, I think we need to take a look at 404C, and certainly the rehearing in Hecker leaves open, as we were careful to do, this question. But there's an original duty of a fiduciary duty that plan administrators have vis-a-vis the participants in a plan, and that's an across-the-board duty. But then there's 404C, which, if it's going to do something separate from merely enforce that duty, I guess suggests that there are some things that would be a breach of fiduciary duty but for the fact that all of the criteria of 404C have been satisfied. But there are going to be a lot of cases where the satisfaction of the 404C criteria overlaps quite a bit with the original fiduciary duty. There's something like 27 different criteria by the time you count them all up. So isn't that really, as a practical matter, what the district court here was finding, that by the time all of these criteria had been satisfied, there was just no room left to show that the duty of prudence had been violated?
I don't think so. I agree, certainly, the district court was careful to go over all the many rule requirements. But the basic question is, if fiduciaries allow participants to invest in an imprudent option, can that possibly be saved by either the statute or the regulations? And I don't think
what evidence was there that the fiduciaries were allowing participants in the plan to invest in imprudent option? Because it seems to me that you're saying just because the Motorola stock fund went down for a while, that automatically became an imprudent option.
That's not exactly the claim. It was true that there were what I would call normal stock price fluctuations in Motorola stock during the class period, generally trading in the low 30s and the 20s. We're not saying that because the stock went up or down a little bit, there was a duty to terminate the stock fund or at least put a freeze on it so people couldn't put any more of their retirement savings in. What we're saying is that the fiduciaries, and especially Mr. Koneman, who was the CFO, he was the central actor with respect to these bad Telsum loans, that he should have foreseen that when the truth came out, the stock would fall precipitously, which is exactly what happened. On April 6th, the stock falls 23% in one day. $100 million-plus dollars of plan assets are wiped out. $7 billion of Motorola market capitalization is wiped out. This was very important information. We're not saying that they should have disposed of the stock or cut it off because one day it was 22 and the other day it was 24. What we're saying is that this was such an important piece of information that it rendered the stock fund simply too risky for retirement savings. They should have at least cut off the fund, and the record shows beyond dispute, instead of not allowing people to put more money in, they raised the cap.
But why wasn't, I mean, this was, you know, there was the Bloomberg News report that came out.
Yes.
The participants had equal access to that information. They may have been taking a longer view of Motorola's fate than simply that bad news from the Telsim transaction. That was obviously a bad event for Motorola. But
well, I think I would agree with that. But I think by the time Bloomberg comes out, you know, the damage is done, so to speak. The stock was trading in the 30s. Now it's $11.50. And directly related to this Telsim problem.
So you think that at some time prior to the duty to file forms with the SEC, they had to pull the Motorola stock fund from the portfolio that was available?
My answer is yes. They did
based
have
on
to.
On inside information.
No, disclosures must, they can't be selective, to be sure.
Right.
But that does not mean that the fiduciaries, which have a duty of loyalty, can continue to withhold important information like this. Yes, they have to disclose it to everyone, but they have to disclose it. And in this case, the facts show they should have disclosed it long before April of 2001. These losses go back to 1999.
Wouldn't that be true of any risky business that Motorola was undertaking, that type of disclosure would need to be made?
Well, I think the Telsim problem is unique. It's not just another loan. It's $2 billion out of a total of $2.8 billion in vendor financing. It's one company in a country that was itself having certain political issues. And then the red flags that we have in our evidence that did not get very much discussion in the district court, I think because of the 404C issue, shows red flag after red flag going back to 1998.
But couldn't you say the same thing? I'm not sure that the word unique is correct. The analogy that's coming to my mind right at the moment is BP, which is experiencing, as we all know from reading the papers, its own set of problems these days. And you could say the same thing about red flags. Everybody's off saying, oh, the Mineral Management Service should have spotted this. I mean, that's an equally catastrophic event from many points of view, not least financial.
More catastrophic.
Yeah, worse. So these kinds of major events happen from time to companies, and I'm trying to figure out how you, in your mind at least, correlate obligations that exist under the securities laws and the like to disclose at various points in time, how you see that as going forward with a company's right to include as one of the investment options a company stock option vehicle of some sort or another, especially once the information becomes publicly known, if a particular participant in the plan wants to stick with the company through the thin period, seeing a future beyond that, why is that imprudent?
Well, what if the fiduciary, I'm sorry, if the participant wants to stick with Motorola no matter what, I suppose, you know, that's his individual choice.
And that's what he can do. Nobody's forcing him to have Motorola. There are 8 other options in this plan.
That's true. Nobody forced him. But I believe the law to be that fiduciaries owe a duty of loyalty to inform participants. This court has said it in different ways on several different occasions. Important information going to plan benefits. The stock fund, in this case, was an important plan benefit.
Didn't I hear
component.
You say originally that it was their duty to pull it from the option?
We
to preclude the investor from investing it.
Yes. Yes. We say several things in the old charter.
It's hardly the same as what you just said. You know, they had the duty to disclose, but you do one part of their night. You said they had a duty to remove that option.
Yes. Yes.
I just don't see that. I mean, in analogous areas, we have focused, I'm thinking of, say, the Summers case. We've said, well, maybe sometimes when the company is just on the verge of collapse, the duty as an ERISA fiduciary trumps the otherwise acceptable option of having an employee stock option plan, for example. But I'm not sure that Motorola was in that kind of dire strait, even though this Telsum transaction was a disaster and it was a very bad event. It wasn't, you know, a collapse the company kind of event.
I do agree with that. But I believe in it was in the Steinman against Hicks case. In the last paragraph, this court said that verge of collapse is not the standard. It's and the statute says it in 1104. It says it's a totality of the circumstances test. The fiduciary must manage the plan in accordance with what a prudent person would do under all the relevant circumstances. And so,
what's the moment? One thing that worries me about your position in a very structural sense is what I think of as the ex-ante perspective. There you are, you're a plan administrator, maybe you're Mr. Koneman or somebody, and you are structuring a plan. So you've chosen 9 investment options in the plan. The plan's going forward. You don't have perfect foresight any more than anybody else does. You know, what is the moment at which your choice of investment vehicles in a plan becomes imprudent?
When it's too risky for that plan, which is a retirement savings plan.
And how often are you, so you pull Motorola stock fund out of that plan? What if the next day it turns out that the Telsum is actually going to be indemnified fully by the Turkish government or something? You know, the whole problem goes away. Then you put it back in again?
Once it ceases to be imprudent, yes.
So this could actually happen on a daily basis, it sounds to me. They turn into a day trader.
Well, that didn't happen here. I suppose it is theoretically possible that the stock could, because of some extreme development, go from being too risky for a retirement account to, you know, they get a check in the mail from Telsum the next day for the whole $1.8 billion or whatever the amount is owed. I guess it could happen.
So when the CFO gets the initial notice, we're going to be late on a payment, then he needs, if he plays that dual role as the fiduciary, he better pull that. He better make sure that's
not. There's a totality of the evidence here that goes beyond one missed payment. There was an initial warning report in 1998 talking about all the risks of dealing with this Telsum outfit. There was a second report in 98, another report in 2000. Telsum got it qualified.
This gets to Judge Wood's question. You know, when does that scale tip so that it has to be pulled, that the duty?
The evidence would show in this case in May of 2000. That's after all the reports, after the going concern qualification, after the stock pledge, which was supposed to be the security. In-house counsel at Motorola testified it was worthless because they could do what they did do, which was, without Motorola knowing it, dilute the stock. So May of 2001, on the evidence. This is not theory. This is on the evidence in this
case. May 2001. You said May 2000.
But no, May 2000. That's the beginning. May 2001 is the end of the question.
2001 is when you say that risk had gone beyond potential to impose the fiduciary duty on him.
May of 2000, yes.
Is Koneman's role unusual, being a CFO with all of the information the CFO would have, as well as playing the role of the fiduciary to the plan?
I don't think it's unusual. I've certainly seen it in other situations. The CFO was on the committee.
So what if Motorola had just said, in order to make sure that inside information doesn't seep over, we're not going to put the CFO on this committee anymore. We're just going to have outsiders.
That would probably cause more problems unless they're independent outsiders, otherwise qualified. That would be a great idea. Wow. That would be not to put on the committee people who are conflicted. This is the perfect case for conflict.
But these people would have kept Motorola stock fund in the plan because they wouldn't have had any reason to take it out.
That's where the duty to monitor and inform appointed fiduciaries comes in. In that case, the claim would not be against the committee, which is in the dark. It would be against the appointors for not informing them of what was going on, which in this case includes the CEO.
Yeah, I'm not sure how this duty to monitor that you envision works either, actually, because at some point you spill over into simply just plan structure and formation. Companies are not acting as fiduciaries when they decide as an initial matter, for example, just to have a defined contribution plan or defined benefit plan or whatever other kind of plan they may want to have. And they probably are not acting as fiduciaries when they decide, you know, what kind of committee they're going to have. There are all sorts of things that they get to do, and that's just them making a business decision in the market. At some point, fiduciary duties step in, but if they, for example, delegated to the plan administrators the authority to choose the investment vehicles, wouldn't that prevent them from having any fiduciary duties with respect to those vehicles?
No, I believe under Lee against Engel, there is an obligation on the part of fiduciaries who appoint people to run the plan day to day to keep them informed of what they have to know to do to fulfill their duties of prudence.
The company has just created the plan, is what I'm imagining. Okay.
I think my time may be up.
Well, you have your rebuttal time, but if you'd like to save that, that would be fine.
Yes, I would. Thank you.
Sure. Mr. Murray?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is John Murray, and I represent the defendant appellees in the Lingus case. We believe that the Court below correctly decided that the 404C safe harbor defense does apply. However, we do think that it's important to recognize that the Court went on to find, in part as part of its 404C analysis, but also beyond that, that this was not an imprudent investment, that the duty of prudence was not violated, and that there was not a breach of any duty to disclose. And so we think that many of the concerns that the Court is raising has raised with Mr. Mills are exactly the drivers that led the Court to reach the conclusion that it did below.
Is there any difference in your view between saying that someone qualifies for 404C's safe harbor and saying that they have simply not breached a fiduciary duty?
I think there...
Is 404C completely duplicative of... Does it just describe the fiduciary duty?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it certainly... we can certainly imagine scenarios where clearly 404C is distinct from the fiduciary duty. A fund could be, for example, fully invested in Motorola stock, even though it's got 8 or 9 options, and that would probably be problematic for an ordinary pension plan if it were not an ESOP and if the fiduciary were doing that. But 404C allows the individuals to make those selections. And in the same sense, I think it goes beyond that. I think it is a broader safe harbor, and it has very specific criteria. Those criteria were met here. In fact, the plaintiffs conceded that virtually all of those criteria were met here. They argued that the risk-benefit profile of the fund was not adequately disclosed, but the court, I think, appropriately dealt with that concern. And then they also argued that they had not been adequately informed to allow them, that information had been concealed. But 404C is a concealment element. It is not a disclosure element. And so there was no concealment here, the court found, and therefore 404C applies.
See, I guess the difference, and this may be quibbling about a small point, but maybe not, that I see is it seems to me that there are some broadly described fiduciary duties that go along with having an ERISA-qualified plan. And they're what I'm thinking of is across the board. At the 404C level, you've moved down a level to questions about the individual participant's management of his or her own investment funds and the individual participant's decisions, if all the criteria of 404C are met, are not things that can be attributed, if you will, to the creator of the fund. So it strikes me we're talking about two different levels of the transaction, the fund management level, perhaps, and then the individual participant doing things with the individual's own money.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that may or may not be. I don't think it's an issue that needs to be reached here because of the facts in this case and because of the judge's alternative finding that there was no breach of the duty of prudence and there was no breach of the duty to not to misrepresent, and there was no breach of the duty to monitor. So because the court found all those things, and correctly, we believe, one really needn't reach the exact scope of 404C. I think it's a question that's left open in the second Hecker decision. I think the second Hecker decision certainly allows for the possibility that some kinds of selection decisions might not be sheltered by the safe harbor. For example, one could imagine maybe a lottery ticket fund would be beyond the pale and therefore would not be sheltered by that.
I was thinking of the Bernie Madoff fund, but
but clearly this is not that case. Motorola still survives 10 years later. There's been no bankruptcy. The stock rebounded a number of times in the meantime from the losses that were experienced. And in fact, there was unrebutted expert testimony that the drop in stock price was not related to the Telsum issue, which is the whole essence of the plaintiff's claim.
Well, I know that. I mean, I guess that there I was taking into account the fact that it was summary judgment. There was some evidence to suggest that the Telsum revelations were material and did have an effect on the stock. There's other evidence that might suggest that the whole market in this area was experiencing a downturn, which it certainly did seem to be. So giving the plaintiffs the benefit of the doubt, maybe this disclosure did have something to do with it. I guess I'm interested to know what your view is at the ex-ante perspective. You're Motorola, you're running this thing, and you know there's going to be a pretty significant hit from this transaction that went bad. Does it have to be all the way down to the catastrophic level that we saw, say, in the United Airlines case, or is something less enough? And if something less is enough, then how much?
Well,
I mean, if Motorola has, I mean, of course, the stock price went down, you know, stock price tanked, basically.
Well, the stock price fell for some period of time between the beginning of the class period and the end.
$11.50 or so, well, 38 if you want to go.
There was a significant fall in the stock price over the course of the class period, and there was even a significant fall on that one day in April. There's no question about that. Now, in terms of what exactly is sufficient, Your Honor, there's an argument that it should be the failing company, the verge of collapse standard, but I don't think you need to reach that here. I think we're far short of that mark. In this case, there simply is no cause for that kind of alarm. It was a fluctuation in the stock price. It was a significant loss to the shareholders. But the extreme measure of using inside information to shut down a fund or, you know, the kind of post hoc review and analysis, I don't think is appropriate. This was a volatile stock. It was portrayed as that to the shareholders. They've been given a clear picture of the wild swings that sometimes occurred in Motorola stock, and they made an informed decision that they wanted to be involved in that.
So you would agree, though, I take it, that if, as Motorola did, there were 9 different options in the plan, if one of those options is an imprudent option, that there's been a breach of fiduciary duty?
I think that is a possibility, certainly, Your Honor. I think the Hecker decision allows for the possibility that there might be a fiduciary breach in choosing a wholly inappropriate vehicle.
Right. So the fact that the other 8 may be wonderful possibilities isn't going to save you if you've put in the package one that's imprudent, because ERISA itself has a protective aspect to it.
I think that's likely true, Your Honor. And again, though, I don't think that this is – I think there may be a beyond-the-pale type of imprudence that would be challengeable. I don't know that ERISA would suggest that you should be able to sort of micromanage and scrutinize them and say, is this a little too much to pay for this particular share of stock? You know, because ultimately what the plaintiffs are claiming here, when you really boil it down, they're not suggesting that Motorola was truly an imprudent vehicle for retirement savings. They're saying that it was imprudent at these prices, which isn't so different from what was going on in
Hecker. Disclosure claims. I mean, your point would be, I think, even stronger if you said, well, you can include in the package stocks that may ebb and flow in value, you know, Motorola, and any one company actually is likely to do that, as long as the participants are given adequate information about that particular stock.
I think that's right within reason. Again, we discussed the, you know, the lottery ticket fund. It may be that no amount of disclosure could cure a choice like that. But I think in general, disclosure will generally resolve any of those issues. And I think that's part of what 404C recognizes, is that a well-balanced portfolio can have some very risky stocks as long as people have the option to balance it with investments that don't present that same kind of risk return profile.
And is it enough just to say Motorola stock is risky, or do you have to say after January 2001 or whatever, pick any date you want, after a certain date, we now have reason to believe this is too risky, and so we're pulling it, or we're going to tell you that it's just become even more risky?
Well, I think if it got to the verge of collapse, you might have that duty to pull it. I think that, you know, Summers suggests that there might be a point there. And I think that makes some sense, that you could reach a point where it is literally no longer prudent at any price. And in that situation, maybe there would be a need to pull that option. Presumably, by the time you get there, the market's going to know it too, though. And I don't know how much you're going to save anybody.
Well, that's why you get into this interesting insider trading business, in a sense, or inside information, I'll say, not insider trading necessarily, because presumably as soon as the information here came out, the market absorbed that information, the stock price went down, and that was that.
And that is, in fact, what our expert testified, that the marketplace for Motorola stock is a robust marketplace that processes information more or less immediately, and that it does immediately adjust, which is in fact why the expert found that the April 16th drop was not attributable to Telsim, because he found that there was no new Telsim information in the Bloomberg report. There may have been new information in the Bloomberg report. There may have been some dire warnings about Motorola's liquidity and its access to credit markets and so forth, but there was no new Telsim information. The information that was repeated about Telsim had already been disclosed, and all the evidence, all the economic literature is that would have been processed and factored into the price already. And that's why the experts said that even though there was a significant drop after a Bloomberg report that did discuss Telsim, there was no correlation to Telsim news. So, Your Honor, we believe that, again, we do believe that the 404C defense applies in this case, but we don't think the court really needs to go there. We think that the information that the court looked at about the disclosures that were made on Motorola stock, the information about Motorola's performance, the viability of the stock, the continued credit ratings and so forth of the stock, mean that this is not a prudence case.
Actually, there's another aspect of the case I wanted to explore for a moment, which is the duty to monitor. The Secretary of Labor mentions that a couple of times as well. After a stock has been put into a plan, what kind of duty of monitoring exists? I mean, surely there has to be something other than the original selection of, say, the Motorola stock fund for your package. Because, you know, if you last looked at your set of stocks in 1963, you know, they may not be a particularly prudent set of stocks or mutual funds or whatever other vehicle in 2010. So what kind of duty of monitoring, and was there some claim that Motorola was not monitoring properly?
Your Honor, I believe there is some duty to monitor, and I think that would be consistent with the Summers opinion, which says that, you know, there comes a point where you need to think about pulling the stock. And so I think there clearly is some duty to monitor. I think it was clearly satisfied by Motorola in this case. One thing that you have to remember is that the people who were the administrators of this plan were Motorola executives in high-level positions, including the chief financial officer, who are well aware of Motorola's financial standing. So the kind of active monitoring that might be required for an outside third-party fund is not the same as one for the company you're living and breathing day to day. And I think in this case, the administrators were fully informed, or very informed about Motorola and about the viability of the company and the ongoing appropriateness of it as an investment vehicle for the retirement plan. And so that constitutes, you know, a level of monitoring that's probably sufficient. They were also receiving reports on a periodic basis. The plan was being audited. Motorola had audited financial statements. Whether there was the kind of active sit around the table and let's all have a discussion every 6 months about whether to pull this stock, I don't know that you'd find that in the evidence, but we believe that there was more than sufficient evidence that Motorola lived up to whatever duty to monitor there is.
All right, so maybe they're monitoring, but let's assume two different participants in this plan. One of them is 57 years old and has only a couple of years left to go before retirement, and the other is 35. Surely the 57-year-old would be much more sensitive to information about how long this, you know, when is the stock going to go down, or, you know, what's happening, and the risks of sticking with the Motorola stock fund than the 35-year-old who's more than happy to wait it out and bet that the company will come back. Again, that gets to the quality of the information and how soon the information, which is what Mr. Mills was talking about, how soon the information reaches the plan participants.
Well, Your Honor, I think in that case you're getting back into the 404C problem, which is that you've got two different participants who have two different objectives. And as long as you give them a range of objectives and good information, and none of the objectives is beyond the pale, recklessly imprudent, I think that they have to live with their own choices, and they have to make their own choices, and we're allowed to do that.
What constitutes good information, I guess, is one of the points that separates you from Mr. Mills.
Okay.
I think if I'm understanding him correctly, you know, that the information these people were getting wasn't quite good enough.
And I think that the information was more than adequate that was provided. You know, I don't think that ERISA requires the level of detail where Motorola is required to report every transaction it's entering into and its current betting on how likely it is to result in a profit or a loss.
How about just the $1.8 billion? Those greater than a billion?
Well, this was a significant transaction. There's no question it was, but it was ultimately a transaction that went bust, and that there was no and that the company survived and has continued to exist almost 10 years later. Also, Judge Rakoff found in the New York decision that Motorola could not, with reasonable diligence, have learned the truth about that. So, and frankly, all of the red flags that Mr. Mills points to, when you go through them, the majority of them are reports that were prepared for people who are not Motorola. There's no evidence that Motorola ever received them. Some of them were post hoc looks, and therefore, you know, were not available to the fiduciaries at the time. We believe that the disclosure that was made at the time was reasonable and was appropriate. There certainly is a lot of gray area that one could go into in trying to draw bright lines here, but we believe that this case doesn't require you to do that. This case is safely on the right side of the line. Unless there are any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Mills, I'm sure you do have something further.
Well, I'd like to make a few points. First, I think the duty of monitoring is important here with respect to all defendants except one. It is not important with respect to Mr. Koneman, because he is appointed. He's not an appointor. He knew everything according to the Arnold and Porter reports. He's the CFO. If he didn't know, he should have known. And I'm going to argue to you that is sufficient under ERISA. I was going to get to it in connection with the deception claim, but the district court said there is a requirement in ERISA that a breach of duty to be actionable must be intentional. The fiduciary must intend to mislead the participants. I look closely at the cases that discuss that, and I admit there is such language in cases such as Ballone and the Brosted case and the Beach against Commonwealth case. But significantly...
Actually, Mr. Koneman is the only one who really has full knowledge of what's going on. I mean, you have a long list of defendants here, Motorola, the entity, the committee, all these various people... But a lot of them are outsiders who don't know a thing about the Telsim problems. And some of them we don't know what's the state of their knowledge.
But I would.
How can we go forward against the people who don't know anything about it?
Well, with respect to those who did not know, they should have known, given that they're on the board of directors of the company. That's the claim in this case.
But I would like, you've got Fuller, you have Ann Jones, Judy Lewin, Walter Matt. You have a lot of people who are not on the board of directors of the company.
They are directors.
I thought they were outside directors.
Well, they are outside directors. I agree. They're not management directors. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
But I think the focus, I guess, I think it came through with the briefs. If it doesn't, let me make it clear. We think we've got a lock case against Mr. Koneman. I admit that's our strongest case. I'm not saying that it's as strong against the others.
And in a special position.
And I don't think that really comes through in the district court opinion, where there's no discussion of the Arnold and Porter reports, the red flag evidence. And I think, again, hate to keep going back to it, but because of how the court read 404C. 404C, the requirements to satisfy, have nothing to do with the prudence of investments. It has long been the law, and Judge Wood, you alluded to this in questioning, you can't put 10 investment options out and say the 9 are okay. Each one has to be prudent. And you could have a situation where satisfaction of those requirements under the statute 404C and the rules, those requirements have nothing to do with prudence. They have to do with diversification and disclosure. I'm sorry.
Yeah, let me just ask you this question. Suppose you were writing our opinion and you wanted to articulate the standard so that plan administrators in the future will know which company business decisions have to be disclosed and when. How would you phrase it?
I think I would paraphrase at least prior decisions of this court, which speak to the duty of fiduciaries to disclose to participants, and it says whether or not they ask, information that they need to make important, I'm sorry, not the word important is wrong, informed decisions concerning their retirement savings investments.
But so you're not going to get into information that's publicly available, information that's not available, information that's been reported to the SEC, information that hasn't reached the point where there's a duty yet to report to the commission?
It makes no difference whether it has to be reported to the SEC. It has to be reported to the fiduciaries, the participants, because there's a duty of loyalty. And it certainly, I think I've said this before, it cannot be selective disclosure. It has to be disclosure to everyone, but that because you have to disclose to everyone doesn't mean that you can get away with not disclosing to your beneficiaries. That is essentially our argument. In the district court, there's a proposition advanced that it would be basically unfair to the fiduciaries because if they sell the stock or they don't allow people to put more money in, then they could be sued for that, as they are here. But, you know, if they don't do it, they could be sued for the other side of it. I think in the Summers case, this court addressed that well. That point at 453 F3rd and 411, that was State Street. The claim there was State Street should have sold the fund, the stock fund, and it didn't. And then the court noted, well, if they had gone the other way, they could have gotten sued. But the court said, but the suit would be of no worry to them. They would bail out of it, I think was the exact language in the opinion, because they did their homework. They had outside appraisers. They sought the advice of counsel. One of the important pieces of evidence in this case is what the fiduciaries didn't do. They didn't seek legal advice. That's been stipulated. They didn't bring in an independent fiduciary to decide or at least even recommend whether to offer the stock fund. That's very common today.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does suggest a whole new layer of bureaucracy for funds, but we appreciate hearing from you. Thank you to both counsel, and we'll take this part of the case under advisement.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.